I'm Mary Nichols, Dean of the College of Continuing Education, and it's such a great pleasure to welcome you to this very special post-election edition of Headliners. For those of you who may be joining us tonight for the first time, Headliners is a monthly gathering for engaged citizens. We discuss topical issues with university faculty whose expertise illuminates the stories in the headlines or whose research itself is making national news. Well, this week's biggest news story, of course, was the historic presidential election and the changing composition of the United States House and Senate. And now national attention is trained on Minnesota as we prepare a recount to verify the results of our hotly contested seat in the U.S. Senate. Our guest this evening has become a familiar figure to those of us who have been avidly following the campaigns over the last several months. She's appeared as a political commentator on every network in the Twin Cities, and at all times of day, I've noticed, and night. Through it all, she's remained well-informed, upbeat, and articulated, and it seemed like she really was enjoying every minute of it. So tonight, we have her all to ourselves. How lucky we are. Catherine Pearson is an expert on the Congress and congressional elections. Before joining the faculty at the University of Minnesota, she received her Ph.D. from the University of California, Berkeley, in 2005, where her dissertation won the Best Doctoral Dissertation Award from the American Political Science Association. She is currently preparing it for publication as the book Party Discipline in the Contemporary Congress. Sounds interesting. Catherine served as a research fellow at the Brookings Institution, and from 1993 to 1998, worked on Capitol Hill as a legislative assistant for two members of Congress. Now she teaches courses on campaigns and elections, and as a scholar, studies both congressional elections and how the Congress works. Tonight, she'll share her insights into how the outcomes of this year's campaigns might translate into next year's congressional session. So please join me in welcoming Professor Catherine Pearson.
Great. Thank you for that nice introduction. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm very much looking forward to all of your questions. So in many respects, it is hard to overstate or even fully grasp the significance of Tuesday's elections. The country elected the first black candidate in history. Barack Obama won by a 7-point margin in what was clearly a change election. In many respects, including public opinion in the U.S. and abroad, change did happen instantly. But the obstacles to policy change are many. As former President Clinton and President Bush would surely agree, even having unified party control of the government does not mean that legislative change is automatic. So tonight, I want to discuss the campaign, the results, and the implications for the next Congress. We had a historically long election. The nomination season started earlier, both with the invisible primary, with the candidates gaining momentum, the primaries and caucuses in Iowa and New Hampshire starting earlier, and on the Democratic side, ending later. The Democratic side witnessed historic firsts, with, of course, Senator Obama and the first woman to be a major contender for a nomination, Hillary Clinton. Superdelegates sort of threw things on the Democratic side into confusion for a while, and there were questions about whether or not the Democratic Party would come together by the fall. On the Republican side, thanks in part to differences in Democratic and Republican rules, with Republicans having some winner-take-all primary states, the primaries were wrapped up by early March when McCain all but assured the nomination. So he was the general election candidate for much longer. But nonetheless, he still added some surprises during the general election season, with this surprise announcement that Governor Palin would be his running mate and suspending the campaign for a brief time, because of the economic crisis. So, as you all know, the presidential election is really a series of state-by-state contests. There are 538 electors. Candidates need 270 to win. Well, Senator Obama did get well over 270, with 364 to McCain's 162, with Missouri and one elector and Nebraska still undecided. So this accentuated his 7-point margin of 53-46. Now, the implications of these state-by-state contests are many. Electors are decided by popular vote in each state, and each state's numbers of electors total the number of senators and representatives combined together. So all states and the District of Columbia have at least 3 electors. This means that some states actually have greater ratios of voters to electors than others. But nonetheless, all else equal, big states are the prize because, of course, in a winner-take-all system, all of their votes go to the candidate that wins the state, even if the margin is very slim, with the exception of Maine and Nebraska. But what happens, of course, is that the elections are really fought for in a small number of states, or battleground states. And this means that many, many citizens, including those in deep blue states and deep red states, where the party, where the outcome is all but guaranteed, miss out on a lot of the process. They miss these negative ads that we saw for so long here in Minnesota. They also miss visits by candidates and their surrogates throughout the campaign season. And in fact, political science research shows that voters in states that are not battleground states are indeed less likely to turn out and, in fact, less knowledgeable about the campaign as well. Now, this was a campaign that had a historic level of interest, so it'll be interesting to see if this research holds in 2008 as well, but I suspect that it will. The Electoral College also means that third parties are excluded from the process. Even when Ross Perot got 19% of the popular vote in 1992, he wound up with no electors. But just to point out the 2008 Electoral College map, it looks like there's a fair amount of red and blue interspersed. But I want to remind everyone what the 2004 Electoral College map looked like. 2008, 2004. So in 2004, President Bush was reelected with a 2.4% edge over John Kerry in the popular vote, winning 286 electors to Kerry's 251. And the interesting thing about 2004 was that only 3 states had actually shifted since 2000. So it seemed like in the 21st century, we were going to be locked into this red and blue nation where there wasn't a lot of change. But in fact, the election of 2008 suggested that those concerns were premature. And most of the battleground states, where the candidates spent the most time and money, were in fact states that had been red in 2004. I'm thinking of Florida and Ohio, which had been traditionally battleground states, but also Indiana, Virginia, North Carolina, states that people did not think would be in play in 2008. But yet they were, and 9 states switched from red to blue from 2004 to 2008. Again, traditional swing states like Florida and Ohio, but new states to the mix. No states, unlike 2004, went the other direction. But this map, I think, really highlights much better sort of trends in varying states. And you can see that very few states are solidly red or solidly blue. So the Electoral College maps, of course, perhaps overstate the polarization and understate the variation within states pretty significantly. Again, the presidential vote, the Electoral College vote was 264-162, and the popular vote was 53-46. This made, so therefore Obama had a much bigger margin than Bush did in 2004. Of course, in 2004, one of the implications, or in 2000, one of the implications of the Electoral College meant that President Bush, as everyone knows, won the electoral vote while losing the popular vote. And early on in the election season, people were expressing concern that that might happen in 2008. Another concern going into 2008 was the possibility of a 269-269 electoral vote tie, in which the House of Representatives would actually be deciding the outcome on the basis of 1 vote per state. So California would have 1 vote, Nebraska would have 1 vote. So that was one scenario that election lawyers and constitutional scholars were absolutely dreading, but did not happen. So what happened in terms of voter turnout? Well, voter turnout was something that people had a lot to say about, of course. And indeed, it looks like, the numbers are not all in, but it looks like 2008 set a record in equaling turnout in 1968 of 62.5% turnout, or 133.3 million voters. And this wasn't quite as high as some people wished for, but nonetheless, it's worth noting that Minnesota appears to have once again hit voter turnout at rates of about 77%, equaling its voter turnout in 2004, which was the highest in the country. Now, why is Minnesota's voter turnout so high? Well, there's several reasons, but one of the most significant reasons is because of same-day registration. All of the states that have same-day registration, it's a small minority, around seven, have particularly high turnouts. Wisconsin has very high turnout as well, in addition to same-day registration. But there's also something unique about Minnesota in terms of social capital or civic engagement, in that Minnesotans tend to be, studies have shown this, more likely to join groups. One scholar, Robert Putnam, wrote a book called Bowling Alone, noting the fact that more and more Americans are likely to bowl alone rather than in groups. And he did note that Minnesota is not quite like that. Minnesota is one of the exceptions and scores high on his social capital scale. So people who are more likely to join groups, know their neighbors, are also more likely to turn out to vote. So it's a combination of political culture, but also registration laws that allow people to go to the polls for the first time and vote and register that day. So what about youth turnout? Now, this was a very big topic in the press. You know, it seemed like youth were particularly energized by these campaigns, especially the Obama campaign with its use of new technology such as Facebook, other social networking sites on the internet, and all of the enthusiasm at rallies. Well, it does look like those in the 18 to 29-year-old demographic increased their turnout by about 2.2 million from 2004. But the thing is, every group increased their turnout from 2004. So in 2004 and in 2000, 18 to 29-year-olds were about 17% of the electorate. And in this election, it looks like these groups are about 18% of the electorate. So even though there's this big increase, the numbers or the percentages are about the same. Thinking about the results, there's actually a big debate in political science about whether or not campaigns actually matter. And as we have all just lived through this particularly long campaign, that seems somewhat hard to fathom. But political scientists and economists, back, you know, in July, before the general election was really underway, crunched a bunch of numbers, numbers that included the state of the economy, the approval rating of the current president, George Bush, and some other demographic factors, and determined that Barack Obama would win the presidency because Democrats had such an edge when it came to these important contextual factors. Now, I don't buy the political science idea that campaigns don't matter, but I do think that these contextual factors are critically important in understanding Obama's victory on Tuesday night. So what are these significant contextual factors? Well, the first is the state of the country, the economic conditions that the country faces, and issues of war and peace. And on exit polls from the election on Tuesday, 75% of the electorate thinks that the country is going in the wrong direction. So if that isn't evidence that this is a change election, I don't know what is. And both candidates, Obama and McCain, were campaigning on themes of change, although it was certainly easier to argue that you were a candidate of change if you were from the out party rather than from the party that controlled the White House. 85% of voters from the exit poll are worried about economic conditions. This is an issue that generally favors Democrats, and it's also an issue that Barack Obama really took advantage of and responded to in a more skilled way in the campaign. But campaign effects aside, the contextual issues of the economy are more likely to hurt the party in power. Now, President Bush's approval was at historic lows, and that definitely hurt John McCain. Even as John McCain would try to quip, you know, if you wanted to run against President Bush, you should have run 4 years ago. But nonetheless, these negative opinions of President Bush were established well before the campaign even got going and were definitely going to hurt any Republican candidate, no matter how skillfully he distanced himself from the incumbent president. And then finally, the partisan identification of the electorate is critically important. So 9 out of 10 partisans vote for their party's candidate. And that was generally true in this election as well. I think the numbers were around 89% in the exit polls. So At the presidential level, not at the Senate level. But generally speaking, partisans vote for their team. But the kicker here is only about two-thirds of the electorate actually identifies with one party or the other. About a third of the electorate, not quite a third, in these exit polls, self-identifies as an independent. Now, when pressed, many of these people will say that they lean toward one party or the other, and Democrats have gained an advantage in leaners. But knowing what the party identification of the electorate is going in is critically important to understanding the outcomes. And here, Democrats had an advantage before the campaign even started, with an increase in Democratic identification over the last several years. So these are contextual factors. Now, what about campaign effects and short-term forces? Well, certainly, the candidates themselves are, in fact, important. Who they are, what their policy positions are. And in fact, open-ended polls over the summer ask respondents to identify the biggest weaknesses of the candidates. And the biggest weakness identified for Senator Obama was his lack of experience. And the biggest weakness for John McCain was his age. Now, throughout the campaign, McCain definitely tried to run on or exploit Obama's lack of experience, but that was seriously undercut by his selection of a vice presidential running mate. But at the same time, that selection then also reminded people of what they had identified as McCain's biggest weakness as well, because, of course, that just increased the likelihood that the vice presidential candidate would actually, potentially become president. So those things mattered. Now, fundraising, in terms of allowing the candidates to get their message out, was also critically important. And in this particular election cycle, Senator Obama was the first general election candidate ever to forego public funding. The $84 million grant given to general election candidates that only stipulates that they don't raise additional funds. The parties can raise more money, but the candidates themselves cannot. And initially, people thought that this would actually hurt Obama. First of all, he had gone back on a promise to accept public financing in the general. And second, because the parties can raise money as long as they spend it independently, people figured between the money that Obama raises and the Democratic Party raises combined, McCain would make up for his shortfall with the Republican coffers. But what wound up happening is everyone was just astounded by Obama's fundraising in September. He raised a record $160 million in the month of September alone, after raising a record $66 million the month before. And this is where the map comes into play. This money really allowed him to move into many more states and make them competitive and put McCain on defense rather than on offense. I don't know if you remember, actually, during the campaign, McCain announced he was pulling out of Michigan because it just seemed unwinnable. And because Obama had so much more money, he was able to go in states that, if he were more limited, he might have had to say, these states seem unwinnable. And this has implication not just for the television ads that they run, but the party organization, the get out the vote efforts, and other things that help other Democrats further down the ticket. So, clearly, Obama ran a very skilled campaign. The campaign was on message. The staff was relatively unified. Unlike the McCain campaign, we're not hearing stories of disarray, disagreement, infighting, shopping sprees, etc. Now, maybe, as the McCain campaign has said, you're more likely to hear those for a losing campaign, but sort of all the way throughout the process, there have been campaign, reshuffling on the McCain side. And then again, certainly the vice presidential selection was an important part of this campaign. 60% of people in exit polls said Palin was not qualified to be president if necessary, although 16% of those people did actually vote for McCain. Anyway, briefly show you the results of some exit polls. Now, these are a little bit hard to read, but nonetheless, they're instructive, particularly when I compare them, show you 2004. So Obama won among both men and women, which was not the case with John Kerry. John Kerry actually lost by 11 points among men in 2004. Obama did not win among whites. Only 43% of whites voted for Obama, whereas 55% of whites voted for McCain. Now, without any context, one might then conclude, well, what does that say about white voters' calculations based on race? But it's important to know that typically, whites are less likely to vote for Democrats generally because In 2004, whites voted at a rate of only 41% for John Kerry. So, could this be an issue of race? Perhaps, but it's definitely an issue of party because we've seen that over and over again. Particularly striking here in 2008, 95% of black voters voted for Obama, whereas in 2004, the numbers were also high, but not quite as high, 88% of blacks voting for John Kerry. Now, strikingly, the difference between Hispanics, 67% of Hispanics voted for Obama, whereas only 56% of Hispanics voted for Kerry. And Hispanics are the largest growing group in the United States, both because of immigration and then naturalization rates and because of fertility rates. And so this has significant implications for the Democratic Party, as does the age cohort. So in 2008, go back here, in 2008, 66% of 18 to 29-year-olds voted for Obama. And political science research shows that party identification is socialized, people are socialized at a relatively young age with their party identification. So to the extent that these young voters who voted for Obama also identify as Democrats, that combined with the partisan gap among Hispanics suggests that the Democratic Party has a lot more to celebrate after Tuesday night than just the election of Barack Obama. On the other hand, it is also possible that some of these effects are very much candidate-centered and very much a judgment of the last 4 and 8 years. Some interesting religious differences and size of place differences as well. People in big cities were overwhelmingly likely to vote for Obama, where if you go to rural areas, 53% are voting for John McCain. So briefly, the comparison with 2004, I highlighted some of the most significant differences. Two other things I want to highlight, and those are the most important issues in the 2008 elections, because this has implications for how the candidates can interpret the election results. Now, clearly, I don't know how well you can see this, but 63% of those who voted said that the economy was the most important issue. That was followed by Iraq at 10%. So 63% economy, 10% Iraq, 9% terrorism, 9% healthcare, and 7% energy policy. So the economy was far and away the most significant issue in this campaign, and as a result, it's going to be far and away the biggest issue that the Obama administration is judged on. Just interesting, because this question always comes up. Among those polled, 2% said that the race of the candidate was the most important factor, but 58% of those voted for Obama. 7% said it was an important factor, 10% said it was a minor factor, and 80% said it was not a factor. And Obama had a winning margin with all four of those groups. So the extent to which race played a major factor in people's votes was not detected in these exit polls. Now, certainly there are issues of social desirability in response, but given the election results, I think that any notion of the Bradley effect can be discounted by 2008. Okay, thinking about who Obama has to work with. Well, the U.S. Senate, this was the map of U.S. Senate races that were actually in play. So there were 35 Senate elections on Tuesday night, and Republicans faced a huge structural disadvantage. As of last week, the Republican Party had spent $34 million for their candidates, and the Democratic Party had spent $67 million for their candidates. Republicans were defending many more open seats than were Democrats, and they had many more vulnerable incumbents. So as a result of Tuesday, we have a much larger Democratic majority from going from 51 to 57 or more, depending on the outcome of three races still undetermined, Democrats. But we also have fewer moderate Republican senators. Moderate Senator Susan Collins was reelected from Maine, despite the fact that it went very heavily for Obama, but some moderate Republicans were defeated and others retired, and Democrats took their seat. The U.S. Senate now has a record of 17 women, so 17%. Still nothing to brag about, but nonetheless, these sort of incremental gains. And again, three outcomes still not determined. The most striking is, of course, with Alaska's Ted Stevens, evidently a convicted criminal is leading the way. Quite striking. It's really amazing. But the thing in Alaska is that because of the last time the Alaskan governor appointed a senator, he appointed his daughter. And so after that, Lisa Murkowski, so after that, the Alaska legislature changed the law. So now the governor no longer appoints the senator. There's a special election. And what people tell me is that voters realize that if they vote for Stevens and then he has to resign, they'll have another election and there'll be another Republican. I hope that's right, because otherwise a majority of Alaskans just voted for a convicted criminal. But nonetheless, in Georgia, a runoff is likely because, unlike in most states, Georgia state law stipulates that the winner of the Senate race must have a majority rather than a plurality, and neither candidate appears to have gotten 50%. State law, critical in many of these elections. And then in Minnesota, we are all very aware of a recount. So this just from a compilation of polls last week, in case anyone had any doubts that the race was very close right at the end and that polls can sometimes be off. I don't really know what to make of this other than that it was sort of an interesting picture to illustrate the upheaval in the Senate race, and that up until the end, it was too close to call, and in fact, after the election, remains too close to call. It's just so interesting that it's this particular Senate race that is still up in the air, since everyone seems so disenchanted with it and sick of it while it was going on. It's the one that we're still stuck with. Now, you know, it is clear over and over in research that partisans tend to support their candidate. But nonetheless, Minnesota serves as sort of an interesting contrast to this because there was evidently a lot of split ticket voting in Minnesota. Minnesota is a state where Obama won 54% of the vote to McCain's 44% of the vote. That's a 10-point margin. Yet, only 74% of Obama supporters voted for Franken, and only 81% of McCain supporters voted for Coleman. Dean Barkley, the third-party Independence Party candidate, won 15% of the vote. And 60% of those who thought that both Coleman and Franken attacked the other unfairly, and then of that 60%, 23% of those voters did, in fact, vote for Barkley, much higher than his 15% average. So a lot going on in the Senate race, but clearly one of the things that kept it from being resolved is that both candidates had extremely high negatives, and that allowed this third-party candidate, with all due respect to Dean Barkley, you know, I think many of the people who were voting for Dean Barkley were simply voting against the two major party candidates rather than for Dean Barkley. I mean, people who are close observers know that he spent a week in the Senate, and he claims he got a lot done, but nonetheless, if you just look at the ad dollar per vote, Barkley won big. He ran one ad compared to the other candidates. So as of this afternoon, someone could have the more up-to-date information, but I think Coleman has a 342-vote lead out of 2.9 million ballots cast. So state officials will start the recount, I think, after November 18th when the canvassers meet, and it could take weeks. Secretary of State Mark Ritchie said at one point that the recount would cost 3 cents per ballot or almost $90,000. So this will continue. But nonetheless, a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate does not hang in the balance. So we'll just have to all be patient. In terms of U.S. House races, again, structural factors favor Democrats. And in this case, because Republicans were defending many more open seats than were Democrats. About 30 Republicans retired and only about 10 Democrats retired. And only one of those Democratic open seats was competitive, whereas several of the Republican open seats were competitive. In the House, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee spent $73 million compared to just over $20 million for the Republican Congressional Committee. So that's just a huge gap in money. And It appeared to have paid dividends. Or actually, I think what really helped was Obama's coattails and a national tide that favored Democrats in the House. So Democrats gained somewhere between 19 and 23 seats. Some of them are still too close to call in the House. And, you know, that's a respectable number. But what is particularly striking about that number is the fact that Democrats gained 30 seats in 2006. And this is the first time since the 1930s that Democrats made big gains two cycles in a row. And it was just in 2002 when Republicans historically picked up seats in the House and the Senate, whereas the midterm party of the president typically loses seats, that people really thought, you know, Republican dominance in the House and Senate were here to stay for quite a while. 2006, both chambers switch, and both chambers make gains in 2008, which is pretty striking. This also illustrates a big regional divide in the House. There are no Republicans anymore in New England. The last, Chris Shays, who had been there for about 20 years, was defeated by an investment banker with little political experience. So clearly Republican or Democratic tide in the Northeast. But again, interestingly, Minnesota's delegation in terms of partisanship remains unchanged. The incumbency advantage clearly worked in favor of many of these candidates, John Klein in the second, Tim Walz in the first, Michelle Bachmann in the sixth. Of course, demographics also a huge factor here. That's the most Republican district in the state. So even after her comments on Hardball and then the subsequent $2 million raised by Elwin Tinklenburg, she still holds on. And then Eric Paulson wins by about 8 points in the third district, the open seat created with Jim Ramstad's retirement. And that was interesting. The race was too close to call, yet he then wins by 8 points, which I think that is the one that has political observers scratching their heads. Either outcome was expected, but the margin, I think, surprised everyone, including pollsters who had it too close to call. So what does all this mean? Well, you can think of elections as one of two things, or some combination of both, which is probably the best way to think of them. Now, candidates like to think of elections as policy mandates. I won. That's definitely a signal that, you know, I get to do what I campaigned on and what I want to do. And in fact, we can see with President George Bush, who won again by a very narrow margin, 2 days after re-election in 2004, says in a press conference, "I earn capital in this campaign, political capital, and I intend to spend it." And he did intend to spend it and tried to spend it, but nonetheless ran into some roadblocks, even with unified Republican control. But for policy mandates to really exist, that assumes knowledgeable citizens who are voting on the basis of issues. Now, this election, I think, really stands out with the economy as clearly the issue that most voters care about. In many elections, and in fact in 2004, election polls revealed that what voters cared most about were moral values. Now, what are moral values? Do moral values have something to do with gay marriage, or do moral values have something to do with providing universal health care? Who knows? So to claim a mandate on the basis of an election where the exit polls reveal that moral values were the most important issue to voters sort of leaves people scratching their heads. And it overlooks the fact that, again, 9 out of 10 voters vote for their party's candidate. You know, perhaps with a lot of knowledge, perhaps with no knowledge of the candidate's positions. Now, political scientists are generally skeptical of policy mandates. And one of the other reasons is because that to claim a mandate, that assumes that the candidates take clear and differing campaign positions. And in this case, I actually think that that requirement has been fulfilled. I think that, you know, Ralph Nader did not gain so much traction in 2008. You know, in 2000, he claimed that there wasn't a big policy difference between Gore and Bush. Now, if you read their policies, there clearly was. But nonetheless, this resonated with some people. Not so much in 2004 or 2008. So the candidates clearly had differing policy positions, although frankly a lot of voters probably couldn't articulate very many, if any, of them. So political scientists definitely are more inclined to think of elections as judgments of performance, of a form of retrospective voting. How did the last 4 years go? How did the last 8 years go? Well, as we can see, a record number of people are concerned about the state of the country. So to the extent that this election was a judgment of performance, I think the outcome is very sort of easy to discern. So what does this mean in terms of challenges and opportunities for President Obama? Well, he faces extraordinary economic challenges that will require quick and skilled action, and he'll want to fulfill campaign promises, but that will be challenging. I mean, that's the one area where neither candidate during the debates would really answer the question. You know, well, you know, senators, which of your policies will you scale back given the economic crisis? Oh, these are all priorities. They'll do them all. Just they'll make some other cuts. So that will be a challenge. Certainly foreign policy and energy will be challenges of potentially enormous, but certainly of great magnitude. Now, unified Democratic control gives Senator Obama huge opportunities. It is certainly much easier to move White House priorities with good margins in the House and the Senate. But nonetheless, Democrats did not attain that magic 60-vote number that would enable them to end a filibuster with a cloture vote. So on major legislation, they will still require 60 votes from Republicans. But despite the fact that the country is polarized along partisan lines, it seems quite clear, based on Obama's rhetoric, that he does want to move beyond partisanship and that he will be interested in working with Republicans in the Senate. And I predict he'll appoint some Republicans to his cabinet as well. But nonetheless, there are fewer moderate senators to work with. I could name them on one hand in terms of his real options of working with Republican senators. But interestingly, I think John McCain may be one of them. It's also worth noting that some of the new Democrats and some of the current Democrats are cross-pressured because they represent very red states. I'm thinking of Montana, now North Carolina, although I actually just went for Obama. But nonetheless, some more conservative states, and they'll be worried about their own reelection. And as just sort of briefly thinking back to 1993 and 1994, that was another change election, another historic election where, for the first time in 12 years, President Clinton was elected to unified Democratic control of Congresses. And actually, the Democrats' margins in the Senate and the House today are relatively similar to what they were back in 1993. And Clinton came in having campaigned on health care, appointed Hillary Clinton as sort of to oversee the health care plan, gave a separate health care speech, but nonetheless, his health care plan never even got a vote in Congress. And then, of course, we all know what happened in the 1994 elections. Republicans pick up 54 seats in the House to swing Republican for the next 12 years. So clearly, overreaching is a problem. Other sort of reflections on the failure of Clinton's health care are from the fact that he included no Republicans from the beginning. He really thought he could just pass health care with Democratic majorities. And the numbers gave him reason to think that. He had 57 Democrats in the Senate. But nonetheless, many of these Democrats were actually quite conservative. And even those who weren't conservative felt very strongly about protecting their committee turf and were not very helpful to him. But despite all of these similarities, the political context is actually quite different from 93 and 94 in a couple of important ways. And one way in which is that Obama's margin is much bigger, and he won a majority, unlike Clinton, who, because of Ross Perot, only won with a plurality. And Obama's coattails are more significant than Clinton's. Several new Democrats can thank Obama for their election to the 111th Congress. And I think also of great significance is that party leaders, this is my second to last slide, I promise, party leaders have much more power than they used to. And party leaders are going to be the first to try to be helpful to Obama. That wasn't necessarily the case with Clinton. And under Clinton, there were a lot of Southern Democrats who still remained. And by and large, that's just not the case today. Both parties have become more ideologically cohesive internally today and further apart from one another. These changes happened well before the Republican takeover of Congress. They began as the South transformed from a one-party to a two-party system, and conservative Democrats began to be replaced by conservative Republicans. But what it means for governing inside of the House of Representatives and the Democratic Party is that Democratic Party leaders are much more likely and much better able to keep their members in line. They're able to exert party discipline, and they're much more likely to vote together. So you can see party loyalty in voting in the House. Republicans are in red and Democrats are in blue. Has crawled up pretty significantly since the mid-1980s. And if you can see in 2007, that is the Democrats' high watermark under Speaker Nancy Pelosi. So Pelosi has been willing to be very clear to her Democratic caucus that she expects members to vote with her, and if they don't, there will be a price to pay. Now, having said that, she does let some members off the hook. I'm thinking of members like Tim Walz, who, although he actually did not have a tough re-election race at all, from the moment he was elected in 2006, everyone assumed he would have a very tough election race. So he and the other first-term members met with Speaker Pelosi every week, and he often voted against Democrats on issues that were important to his constituents. And I'm sure he'll continue to do that. But with larger margins, Democrats will be able to get that 218 magic number in the House. So, you know, what this means is that institutional changes have given party leaders more power over their members and over committee chairs. So the committee chairs that stalled the Clinton health care plan will not have that option in the Congress ahead. And if they do plan to stall a bill, party leaders will simply move it around them. One of the committee chairs who helped stall the Clinton health care bill in 1993 and 1994 was John Dingell, who was the longest serving Democrat in Congress from Michigan. And he tried to do that with Democrats' energy bill in the last Congress. And so Pelosi simply appointed a task force which moved a bill around him. And it was just announced today that Henry Waxman from California plans to challenge him in his bid Dingell's bid to continue to be the Commerce Committee chair. And it's likely that he will win this challenge because Democrats know that they have a short window to pass some of these issues that Obama campaigned on and that congressional Democrats campaigned on, and they don't want recalcitrant committee chairs to stop them. So I'm going to conclude with the fun map for you all to look at rather than increases in party loyalty in the House and open it up to all of your questions.
We're going to be circulating around with some mics for your questions because we're recording this so it can go on the web. And let me start right here in the middle.
The New York Times had an editorial recently talking about what Bush hoped to do with the next 11 weeks, which was to open up certain areas for oil drilling, et cetera, some civil rights actions, and there was a third area. And I was wondering if there's anything that Congress can do in terms of calling a special session, or are they impotent in the face of what the administration wants to do between now and January 20th? In fact, it's not quite January 20th. I think they have until late November to pass these. And so there's a really very short window for anyone to oppose this.
So President Bush still can indeed issue executive orders, and in fact, some that can be consequential. And he very well may, but it's not a particularly good strategy because one of the first things that unified party, Democratic Party control will do on January 21st is to undo many of these things. We saw that, in fact, the second day of Bill Clinton's term, he issued actually executive orders to undo some laws that had been signed. So it works both ways. So it is possible, but in terms of the long-term implications, it seems pretty clear that a Democratic Congress will undo a lot of this. And, you know, one might think that with public pressure, you know, he might think twice about doing this, but he might not. And also look for pardons. We certainly saw a lot of pardons during the final days of the Clinton administration as well. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see a lot of pardons, which Congress will likely do nothing about, perhaps investigate them in the next session. But I'm not sure to what end. So that's sort of an unsatisfactory answer. But Congress had talked about calling a lame duck session, but I haven't heard that. I haven't heard any noise about that recently.
What would you give to be an undergraduate poli-sci student at the university again and be able to work in this kind of laboratory every day? We've got a question back here.
I was wondering what you think the future of public campaign financing is.
I think that there's no doubt that it will have to be reformed. You know, since the 2000 election, the major candidates have foregone public funding in the primaries because it is so restrictive in terms of the spending limits and what they can do in the early states. So it was pretty clear that public financing was already dead in the primaries. But again, Obama's the first candidate to forego public funding in the general. So they could just simply massively increase the public grant. But I don't know how that would go over with the public in bad economic times. Or they could scrap the entire thing and try to find a new system. The interesting thing about Obama's fundraising is he definitely raised a lot of money from huge donors. But in September, his average contribution was $87. And so it's sort of unclear as to what the impetus will be for reform, because I think that, you know, the idea of getting, you know, these huge contributions where there's some concern about a quid pro quo, I think will be on the agendas of some members of Congress. But on the other hand, sort of encouraging people at very low levels, at the grassroots level, to make small contributions and then feel more invested in the campaign, more invested in the process, I think a lot of legislators don't see as such a bad thing. And I think if the public understood that dynamic, you know, there wouldn't be a public outcry about a campaign finance system that encourages, you know, a massive number of very small contributions. But it's these very big contributions, which Obama did receive a lot of as well, that I think will come under scrutiny. Now, at the same time, the parties can still raise, you know, all the money they want to as long as they spend it independently. So reform, for reform to be successful, it would have to have many components, and it runs up, of course, against the First Amendment and Buckley versus Valeo, the Supreme Court decision in 1976, which made it very clear that there can be contribution limits but no spending limits, because that would run afoul of the First Amendment.
What effect do you think that the work of George Lakoff and Drew Weston, the linguist and the psychologist, have had on the election since the last congressional election and this current election, trying to teach the Democrats to get their message out in a different way, using different language? Weston doing brain research, showing what kind of reactions people have to how the message is put. Lakoff suggesting that Democrats stop talking about taxes and talk about investing in our country and things of that nature. I noticed that Obama and all of the people running have stuck to the middle class and have not mentioned the poor, which is one of the things that Weston found was effective.
Yeah, in terms of the actual, to what extent have they met with these scholars and sort of specifically taken their advice? I don't know the answer to that. In the sense, you know, there were newspaper articles about this sort of percolating in 2004, 2006, but in terms of the actual sort of, you know, logistics of this and whether or not it happened, I don't know. But I think one of the successful things that Obama did was from the beginning frame this election as an election of change. And that made sense with sort of everything that was going on and the public's unhappiness with President Bush. But that was also a very effective strategy against Senator Clinton, because she, you know, decided to run. And you know, as a woman, it made sense in terms of gender stereotypes that suggest that women are sort of less likely to be leaders or have agentic leadership qualities. You know, Clinton campaigns on experience to sort of overcome that. Obama campaigns on change. And clearly, I mean, sort of, you know, all of the other things about their campaigns aside, the frame of change really resonated. And it was a change election, but he capitalized on the theme of change early on. We did hear a lot about middle class tax cuts. It was sort of interesting. One of the you know, one of the sort of Republican frames was that Obama, you know, sort of redistribution, socialist, sort of some of that language. And there was this sort of striking email that was floating around about a story about, you know, Obama wanting to give a waiter's $10 tip to a homeless person instead. And was this, did he really want to do this? Someone asked me. And I said, have you heard any of the candidates talk about homeless people? I mean, you know, no, the frames are all about, you know, middle class. That's where the votes are. So it's sort of a cynical interpretation, but I feel like I haven't totally answered your question, but sort of some of my random thoughts about frames.
I have a question here. From your point of view, with all the information and data you have, what's the future of the viability of a third party?
I think as long as the U.S. has single-member districts and the Electoral College, the future viability of a third party is very low. Add into that the campaign finance system, but single member districts, you know, first past the post system, instead of a proportional representation system, basically mean that individuals consider voting for a third party a wasted vote. Now, I realize in two congressional districts, a third party candidate just got 10%, and Dean Barkley just got 15%. Jesse Ventura won in 1998. But Minnesota really is sort of the high water mark for third party candidates. And unless there is structural change in terms of our electoral and representational systems, I think it's unlikely, because some of these third party candidates run from the far left or the far right, some run from the center. And as long as people, the majority of Americans, sort of feel a psychological attachment to one party or the other, it's sort of hard to see how anytime remotely soon or without some structural changes, third-party candidates can consistently be viable. Now, will there be elections that for various candidate-centered reasons that third-party candidates win here and there? Sure. But in terms of a, you know, third-party movement with a platform and a consistent set of office holders from one cycle to the other, I don't see it coming anytime soon.
Large campaign contributions, I think, are assumed to, you know, drive a candidacy, you know, into being elected. You want to comment on large campaign contributions maybe given to a perceived winner? To ride along on, you know, who might be the winner rather than the giver donating to who they would prefer to have as the winner.
You see this most strikingly looking at members of Congress. So members of Congress, incumbents, get the lion's share of political action committee contributions. So before Republicans took over Congress in 1994, Democrats received the majority of campaign contributions, even on a per capita basis, from the business community. Now, that sounds sort of odd. You know, why are Democrats getting more money from the business community in the early 90s than are Republicans? Because Democrats controlled the committees. Democrats were in power. Democrats set the agenda. And this is just a point to illustrate the fact that political action committees give money to get access. And so they want to give to the incumbents because they're likely to be winners. Now, individual contributors still give more money to incumbents than they do challengers, but the discrepancies aren't quite as large. But with only the exception of very ideological political action committees, most other political action committees give to incumbents because they want to give to the people who are in power and be more likely to win. Now, campaign finance reform did end, and political scientists disagree about both the effects and whether or not it was a good thing, but I'm definitely of the camp that campaign finance reform, the McCain-Feingold legislation, actually was a very important step, and it ended the unlimited contributions that individuals could make to political parties, which could very much be a quid pro quo. But when an individual is limited to $2,300 and a PAC to $10,000, you know, and members of Congress and elected officials are getting so much of this money from multiple sources, I guess, you know, political scientists, I think, actually worry about that less than your average citizen. I don't know what that says, but.
Joe Lieberman went from the vice presidential candidate in 2000 to a visible supporter of John McCain in 2008. What's likely to be his fate with respect to his ability to caucus with the Democrats or with respect to his committee chairmanship?
That is a very good question. In fact, he met with Senate Democratic Leader Reid just this afternoon, and I guess the result of their meeting was no result. This is an interesting one. So, Senate Democrats have not been pleased with McCain for a while. They were upset when he endorsed McCain, but it was really when he campaigned so hard for McCain, spoke at the convention sort of so strongly, really against Obama. That, I think that really turned the tide. And so seniority is very important in the Senate in terms of determining committee chairs. But I think by the same token, you know, with the advantages of the majority party come the spoils, like being a committee chair. And the idea for Senate Democrats to have Joe Lieberman, who campaigned so hard for McCain and against Obama, be in charge of the Senate Government Affairs Committee, which is in charge of oversight of the White House, just does not sit well with very many Senate Democrats. So for the first time, well, there's actually some other changes brewing as well about Byrd. But, you know, this may be a new precedent in terms of taking away a senator's committee assignment. He's or committee chairmanship. He's chair of two different committees. The Democrats needed him when their margin was 51-49 with Lieberman for organizational purposes. You know, they don't want to lose him in terms of having his vote. And so I think it's unlikely that they would kick him out of the Democratic caucus because that doesn't benefit anyone. But I do think it's likely that one way or another, he will not be a committee chair, maybe a subcommittee chair, but not a committee chair in the next Congress. I sort of wonder how many Senate Democrats even talk to him.
I have two questions that are really unrelated, but I ask them both. The first one is, speaking of Harry Reid and Pelosi, is Obama on the same page with them? Do we know, are they looking to do the same sorts of things? Do we know anything about that? And the second one is, given that the Republicans ran their campaign heavily on Obama having new experience, how do they justify this concept that Sarah Palin is sort of the front runner for 2012?
Right. Two different questions. We'll take the first one first. So I don't know, but I suspect that there are going to be just a perpetual series of meetings between Obama and Pelosi and Reid. And unlike the situation with Bill Clinton, with Jimmy Carter, even with President Bush, although there was a high degree of congressional loyalty to him, they will be working very closely together. Obama also came out of the Senate. Pelosi is a big fan. You know, he knows Reid well. And they all have common interests in passing an economic plan, a health care plan, an energy plan, and, you know, passing that in quickly. Now, Obama may have more of an incentive, certainly than Pelosi, to reach out to Republicans. Reid does because of the necessity of 60 votes. But I think, generally speaking, they will be on the same page. Now, Rahm Emanuel is, of course, the number three Democratic leader in the House right now. It was just announced today that he'll become Obama's chief of staff. That will only sort of improve the Congress. I mean, not that it needs improving, but that will just sort of highlight the importance of the relationship with Congress. And so, unlike some past presidents who've really struggled with Congresses of their own party, I just don't see that being a factor here. And with the new members, even those from Republican areas, they're so appreciative of Obama for his coattails and helping them get elected. I think congressional relations will actually work quite well. In terms of Palin, you know, she may run for the Republican nomination in 2012, but I've only read blurbs of the Newsweek article that I guess is coming out or came out that is talking about sort of the serious infighting among the campaigns and how, you know, really it was such a last-minute decision. And if you just look at the polls, it was clearly not a good decision for McCain. It hurt him in terms of his supporters. But she also was obviously very well loved by the conservative Republican base. I mean, the crowds at rallies definitely increased dramatically once she was on the ticket. So whether or not she can go back to being governor of Alaska and gain some more experience and sort of build up a record and some expertise to run in 3 years, 2.5 years, 2 years, whenever this starts, is a little bit, you know, is less clear. She also could become the senator from Alaska, depending on what happens. She was an extraordinarily popular governor. Her approval ratings were through the roof. Now, whether among Republicans and Democrats, whether or not, you know, I'm sure Democrats would now not be likely to vote for her for the Senate, but it's such a Republican state, I could easily see her getting elected to the Senate and then using that to campaign as well. But she would face a tough nomination struggle.
With the use of new technology for grassroots organizing in the campaign, how do you see that now being extended to be an advocacy tool for legislative change?
That's a good question. So you mean, so coming from the grassroots to influence Congress?
Right.
Sort of in multiple ways. I mean, members of Congress, you know, want to be responsive to their constituents. So the extent to which they hear from their constituents who are organizing, you know, with the help of technology, I think that's effective. Now, so the, you know, mass email sort of chains that are all clearly generated, you know, is less effective than individual contact with a slightly different message. So, well, I mean, so my own perspective on this is a little bit dated. So when I worked on Capitol Hill, the postcards that were all clearly generated by a group that all looked exactly the same with the same message carried less weight than the individually written letter that was, you know, distinct. So I think, you know, in terms of advocacy, there'll have to be some coordination so that so members of Congress think that coming from each constituent, the appeal is genuine. But in terms of organizing and getting people together and lobbying days and just awareness of issues that are coming before Congress, I mean, I think that the opportunities are really endless.
I have a question about the future of the Electoral College. I gather several states have passed laws that would bind their Electoral College electors to vote for whoever had the popular vote in the whole country. Are you familiar with this? There are several states that apparently have passed such legislation.
Or have not passed it, but
well, there,
have
I thought there were a few that had passed it and quite a few were considering it.
That would bind the
well, it would bind their electoral college members to vote for whoever had the national plural or the majority, provided a sufficient number of states had similarly passed legislation so that they could pass who was elected president. Do you follow?
Oh, provided a sufficient number of states.
It's kind of mathematically complicated, but it would make the Electoral College mute.
Right, right.
Moot.
But so there are a variety of Electoral College reforms that different states have talked about. I actually don't know if any states have done that. Certainly different states have considered different options. One option that some states have had on the ballot is to have, like Maine and Nebraska, have proportional Electoral College representation. California tried to do this a couple years ago, which Democrats, needless to say, were quite distressed about because California's 55 electoral votes, you know, being split 35 to 20 would dramatically, you know, change an Electoral College map. Colorado tried to do this by initiative. So far, only Maine and Nebraska have this, and they're such small states that it's of little consequence. And, you know, this election, one of Nebraska's five electoral votes may actually go for Obama, and the other four stay on the McCain side. I think Electoral College reform is unlikely anytime soon. And the reason I think that is because after 2000, that was when the time was ripe. You know, it was clearly a contested election. Florida's electors, you know, that was in itself contested. President Bush lost the popular vote, and sure, there were a lot of editorials arguing for electoral college reform. But if we went to a direct national vote system, there would be many flaws with the voting process that we just don't know right now. I mean, not surprisingly, we're hearing about problems in Minnesota's precincts and some various issues because of this recount. Whereas we wouldn't hear of them if one candidate won by a large margin. So I think that Electoral College reform would also necessitate some serious voting equipment upgrades. And also people would have to think about the consequences. For candidates to run a national campaign, they would concentrate themselves in large, dense areas and basically overlook sort of rural, sparsely populated areas. Now, is that better or worse than spending all your time in Ohio and Florida? It's different, but there would be a lot of different implications. Sort of the proportional state, you know, two electors go to the candidate who wins the state, the others go by congressional district. Well, redistricting would be tied up in the courts every 10 years for years because, of course, gerrymandering of congressional districts would affect outcomes that would then affect the presidential vote as well. So there's no easy solution, and I don't predict change anytime soon, particularly if we don't see another election like 2000 anytime soon.
I have a question. Even though Obama won by quite a bit, we're really, when you look at many of the other issues on the ballot, we're still quite centrist. I mean, they voted down gay marriage, constitutional amendments in many states, et cetera. And Obama's going to have to rule or preside from somewhere a little left of center as opposed to the Bush administration. But now he's nominated Rahm Emanuel as his chief of staff. This guy is not exactly a centrist. And I'm just wondering if that was a good move or what.
So Rahm Emanuel, I mean, I agree with your point that, you know, Obama certainly will govern from a different perspective than George W. Bush, but probably from a more centrist position than many of the people who supported him did. Although, as you note, you know, given the results of the gay marriage, the anti-gay marriage amendments in three states, and that you know, Obama certainly won California handily. Yet, by the same token, they passed Proposition 8. I mean, clearly, people who voted for Obama also voted for a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. So, you know, votes are not necessarily policy mandates or you know, approval of specific ideologies. But in terms of Rahm Emanuel, I mean, he is extremely pragmatic, and he has experience in the Clinton White House. And so I think it's his experience as someone who has successfully run for and served in the House. He was the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee in 2006 with sort of, you know, a bigger victory for Democrats than they would have thought possible. And so I think that's, you know, it's not so much what are his policy positions, but what are his pragmatic political and organizational skills and White House experience. And so that is where I really see the Rahm Emanuel pick is coming in, not so much for where he stands on any given issue.
It appears that the religious right did not have as much influence on this election as previous ones. Would you comment on that and some estimate of its impact in the future?
Sure. So, I mean, certainly in terms of vote choice, you know, the implications for this election were the same in the sense that exit polls show that people who go to church more than once a week were overwhelmingly likely to vote for McCain, and evangelical Protestants were more likely to vote for McCain as well. But the question really comes at sort of influence in terms of organizing on the election. And you know, there will still be a lot of analyses after the election yet to come. But this election was definitely, you know, both candidates definitely fought over the center. Elections are always about mobilizing your base on the one hand, but at the same time, winning over enough swing voters or independent-minded voters to actually win the election. And I think that given all of the conditions in the country and the campaign, Obama was better positioned going in as a Democrat rather than a Republican in this year and ran a better campaign that was better able to attract swing voters. And so, I mean, in the sense that, you know, I can't tell you whether or not the numbers in terms of people who, you know, are active in politics and are part of the religious right. I don't know the actual comparisons of those groups or even necessarily turnout in this election. But I think that, you know, in part, the future will depend on sort of other levels of office in election years to come and the strength of the grassroots organization.
Ms. What, in terms of the future of the election process, it's my understanding that early voting and other means of improving the election turnouts had some significant impact on this election. To what extent can we expect an expansion of those kinds of things which will improve the American turnout in elections?
That's a great question. Early voting was clearly very popular in the states that had it this year. I think an estimated 40 million people voted early, somewhere between a fourth and a third of the electorate. And obviously not all states have early voting. Minnesota's really only form of early voting is an absentee ballot, whereas in several states, people could actually go vote as if it were election day at various city, county, federal offices. I even heard of early voting at shopping malls, which gets to a larger point, which is that states each state passes its own election laws and has its own election administration and has its own voter equipment. And so there are massive variations from state to state in terms of all of these things. But given the success of early voting, even though people were waiting and willing to wait 5 to 6 hours, I suspect that more states will move to implement early voting, because every state likes to have its turnout high and brag about that and not to have any problems, even though they're sort of unwilling to spend money on these things. So I do predict that given the enthusiasm for early voting in this election, more states at the state level will move to do those things, but it won't be anything federal.
Thanks for coming out tonight. And I was just wondering, looking back at the appointment of Emanuel as chief of staff, what, from another perspective, why would he give up his power in the House to become chief of staff?
That's a good question, because many people said that Rahm Emanuel, currently in the Democrats' number three position, is a rising star and was in line at some point to become Speaker of the House, which is, you know, constitutionally number three. But given sort of, I think, both his personal connection to Obama, their personal friendship, they're both from Illinois, they're friends, and I think really the great challenges and opportunities facing the country right now, I suspect that he sees this as a better way to influence what happens in the next 4 years. Now, whether or not he would ever think, and then maybe I can get back into the House or Senate, you know, perhaps, maybe, actually. But in terms of, you know, what he can do here and now, I suspect that he felt like he could do more as chief of staff, you know, combined with this loyalty to his friend.
Over here on the left in the front.
I've got question two. Number one, what's your analysis of the postmortem of the Republican Party right now? And are they on life support? And number two, if you were advising the Republican Party, what would be the most potent strategy or strategies that you would advise for them to change their status in 4 years?
Great question. Great question. And Vin Weber, former Republican congressman, respected Republican in Minnesota, spoke at Humphrey yesterday and was sort of pondering some of these thoughts that, you know, the Republican Party really has some challenges ahead and needs to think about sort of an identity. You know, both parties are big tent parties. There are only two major parties in the country. They both have to sort of bring together a lot of people with differing ideas. But, you know, I think Republicans have been increasingly less successful about doing that. So from the exit polls I showed earlier, you know, I think 43% of Hispanics voted for Bush in 2004. So not a majority, but a pretty good size of the Hispanic population. And then the percentage of young people, again, not a majority, but not so overwhelmingly Democratic. So in terms of thinking about the future, I would advise the Republicans to try to recapture some of these Hispanic voters and also think about ways in which to appeal to some young voters. And maybe that's emphasizing particular issues like energy, technology, and not focusing on social issues, which definitely the conservative position on social issues is less appealing to young people, but really thinking about future demographics, and in particular, I think those two groups.
A question over here, Arlene.
I have to preface this because of longevity. I'm an old Hubert Humphrey Democrat. And what I thought this election was like is John F. Kennedy, when he was elected, it was kind of a changing of the generations. Mm-hmm. And because you're young and you have much more knowledge of technology in that, it's my thinking, and I want to ask you if you look at it the same way, that Obama in his group was very successful because they have a background and understanding of technology.
I think that that definitely helped. I mean, every age group went for Obama, but I think that that definitely helped. So at one point when Senator McCain said he didn't use the internet, that was not a good strategy. really, really not a good strategy. But I'm so glad you said I'm young. One of my students the other day said, since you're old and remember more elections. It's like, okay. So thank you for that perspective. One of my students is in the class. He remembers that. Yeah. All right. You tell Ben this. Anyway. But yes, I think that technology is important. And, you know, I mean, everything from, you know, the websites with information to campaign contributions to the Facebook, you know, have you voted? Donate your status to I voted for so-and-so today. I mean, it's just so prevalent. And I'm at sort of, you know, I don't really even feel like that's my generation, but I've sort of given in and have the whole Facebook thing. And it's just everywhere, the election. And, you know, young people today are so plugged in, whether it's Facebook or other social networking or Twitter. I mean, it's fascinating, and I think only getting more and more prevalent. So Obama's ability, his campaign's ability to key into this, and then his ability to sort of, you know, recognize it, I think was helpful in that young demographic.
Twitter was something that happened when you need a pacemaker, right? No? Over there, yeah.
One of the changes this year, coming back to Minnesota, is the judicial rules with regard to elections. There were some changes with regard to party identification and identification of issues that didn't seem to have much impact on the elections, at least from what I saw. And there are proposals in Minnesota to make changes to how we select judges. Do you think that this election had any impact on those, or the lack of intensity had an impact on them?
Yeah, I don't know that I can adequately answer that question. I mean, you know, since party identification is such a strong heuristic, especially when there's not a lot of information about the candidates, I mean, pretty much, you know, everyone who was paying any attention knows something about McCain and something about Obama. So, you know, if your most important priority was something that, you know, ran counter to the candidate of your party, you know, you could cross party lines to vote for a presidential candidate that you know a lot about. But as you go down the ticket, people just know less and less about individual candidates. And so if, you know, party identification became the rationale for a vote choice in judicial elections, I think it would really just sort of, you know, turn it into a contest of which party is stronger in a district or county or particular electorate at that time, which is, you know, many people argue, and I am inclined to agree with, not the best way to go about appointing these particular office holders. So I'm not really sure that interpreting these election outcomes is necessarily a good window to think about the partisan election of judges, but instead to think about them in terms of, you know, just basically people self-identifying as one party or the other, unless it becomes an election with just a lot of information and a lot of campaigning. But from what I've seen, I don't see that as being particularly likely.
Catherine, let's go to the center here.
From the races that I watched this year, this seemed like a year where negative advertising wasn't very effective and may even have backfired in some situations. I'm curious what research says about negative advertising, whether you think anything may have changed this year.
So research generally says that negative advertising is used because it works. It's more memorable. And in fact, there's quite a line of research in political science which actually illustrates with empirical data that negative advertising also has much more policy content. So if you see a positive ad, you know, hi, my name is Catherine. You know, I like puppies. Here's my family. La, la, la. You know, whatever. But if you see a negative ad, if you run a negative ad, you're more likely to make the ad about a policy issue, cite your source, you know, according to the Star Tribune, my opponent, or according to Roll Call Vote 27, my opponent, and to make them sort of based in fact, and then contrast your position with some other policy position. So political science research actually isn't too hard on negative advertising. You know, it's memorable, it works, but research does show that it is effective in decreasing support for the candidate who's attacked, but also decreasing support for the attacker. But this campaign, I think, really illustrates that negative campaigning can definitely backfire. I mean, the airwaves were saturated, and when there's a third-party alternative, negative ads drove a lot of people to Dean Barkley in the Senate race. In the North Carolina Senate race, Elizabeth Dole had a tough race as an incumbent to begin with. But nonetheless, when she ran an ad suggesting that her opponent Kay Hagan, the challenger, held a secret fundraiser in the dark sponsored by the society that doesn't believe in God, and then had a woman's voice as if it were her at the end saying, there is no God. That was a very ineffective negative ad because it allowed Kay Hagan to then run an ad saying, I'm a Sunday school teacher. You know, how dare she suggest these things? And one commentator on election night said, not only did that ad ruin Elizabeth Dole's chances of winning re-election, it also ruined her reputation for good. So there are circumstances in which a negative ad can really, really backfire. But generally speaking, if they're contrast ads, you know, my opponent wants to privatize Social Security and bankrupt seniors, and I want to, you know, do this to Social Security, there's some informational content in there, and they're pretty effective.
Question over on the left here, Farley.
Yes, I have a question relative to the voting day. I don't know whether we're the only country that does it in the middle of the week. A lot of countries do it on the weekend. Would that change the ability and have more people come out? And is that something that could ever change?
You know, that's something that's talked about in terms of election reforms. And sort of the history of Tuesday has to do with, you know, the weekend and farming and how long it takes to get to town from, you know, 18-something or other. But the U.S. does have lower turnout than major industrialized countries. But the U.S. also has more elections, more office holders, and tougher barriers to registration. So if you just look at registered voters, turnout in the U.S. is actually relatively comparable to other Western democracies. So the idea of having a national voting holiday or having voting on a weekend, you know, that has been floated, but it's never quite gotten enough momentum to pass. You know, there have been relatively few electoral reforms. You know, Motor Voter in 93, the Help America Vote Act, and they did some things to sort of reduce the costs of voting. But for whatever reason, the idea of weekend voting has never really taken off, I think, because they think people might be out of town or I don't know. But at least in Minnesota, the state law says that your employer can't punish you for being absent in the morning. Yeah. But lowering the costs of voting is definitely a good way to increase turnout, no doubt.
Let's go back to the Senate. I've got a follow-up on the early voting. If we have large numbers of people voting in the middle of October, what does that do to late-inning campaigning?
Very good question. It makes any last-minute October surprise sort of irrelevant. It makes last-minute changes in the dynamics of a campaign sort of irrelevant. But, you know, but the candidates are strategic. They know this. Early voting is going on. So they were targeting states that had early voting and going to those states and telling their biggest supporters to go vote now. And so it does change the dynamics, but in ways that the candidates are aware of and taking into consideration. You know, the extent to which there's late breaking news, yeah, it matters. But I've got to think that people who are willing to stand in line for 5 hours in the middle of October and vote for one candidate or the other are pretty strong supporters and unlikely to change their mind in those 2 weeks anyway. Now, what it means for down-the-ticket races and any revelations that come out there is another story. But candidates, you know, they're strategic about targeting states with early voting and emphasizing that.
I'm wondering about the recount and what are the possibilities that it will actually change what the outcome looks like it is now and what are the factors at play?
So in terms of the chances that it'll change it, I really just flat out don't know. Is it possible? Of course it's possible. You know, would I bet money on the person who's ahead? Yeah, but I wouldn't want to bet. So I should say, when I worked for a congresswoman from Los Angeles in 1994, the day after the election, her opponent declared victory because she was behind by about 300 votes. And 3 weeks later, she nonetheless won re-election. So my own perspective on this is sort of anything can happen. Actually, she was first behind by 800 votes, then about 300. So, and she still serves in Congress to this day. So that's sort of my own take on this. But one of the things that they'll do with this hand recount is, you know, they'll find all the ballots that, you know, people may have circled instead of filled in or X'd or done something strange to. Is there a reason to think that they would disproportionately favor one candidate or the other? Not really, unless they're first-time voters who don't read the instructions. But I can't imagine that they're going to be sort of a 300 and some odd of those ballots. But can there be weird things that happen, like the total change today because some precinct forgot to put a 1 in front of 24 and it was really 124 and not 24? I mean, so I think that anything could happen with this recount. But I would not want to make bets one way or the other.
Not a betting woman. I think this tonight's headliners is set the record for good questions and good answers. Big Q&A. One last question in the back here, please.
I have a question to follow up on this judicial question. This is very troublesome to me because we're asked to vote on a whole string of judges about whom we know nothing. And I don't know how our judges are really selected. And I do know that in states in which they run, it becomes very partisan. And trial lawyers back the heck out of people. And you get places like Mississippi where if you have a class action suit or an injury suit, you try and get it tried there because you can make a ton of money. And yet, if we get into judges campaigning, that becomes very negative also. I'd like to know what's a reasonable answer to how we get good judges and nonpartisan judges?
Yeah, and that, I mean, that's a question I don't want to end on I don't have a good answer for you, but that is sort of the truth. But it has to do, I think, with the candidate emergence process, sort of from a level that comes before these candidates are actually on the ballot. Because, right, the partiality, I mean, certainly, you know, we want our elected leaders, even if they run negative campaigns, to represent all of us. And that certainly was the note that Obama and McCain, you know, they were both trying to strike that note on Tuesday night. But the case of judicial elections makes that a little bit more complicated. And so I don't know, I don't have a good answer to that. But I think the place to look is sort of the candidate emergence process. You know, who was running? How did they get to be the candidates running? Sort of what is their experience? And is there a way to have the selection process on something other than a campaign that gets negative? I mean, is there a way to sort of put some checks on that process or give voters information that doesn't come from sort of a campaign funded by outside groups or the parties?
Is it possible to do it with some sort of an appointment process through the legislature or attorney general's office or some other?
Sure. Have a commission that a bipartisan commission that evaluates these potential judges on the basis of expertise and legal record.
Catherine, you have just shared a flood of information and a wealth of insights, and your passion for your subject is just so exciting. It's infectious. I want to thank all of you for your great questions, and Catherine especially, thank you for sharing all you have with us tonight.
Thank you. Great questions.